This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have State Representative Hal Slager in the studio with us to talk about his take on how the 2017 General Assembly session went and some of the issues that affect Northwest Indiana residents and businesses and the like as a result of the legislative session. Representative Slager, thank you for being with us in the studio today.
Well, thank you for having me on, Chris.
Well, first, after coming back after a long session, this is the longer of the two, the dealing with the creation of a two-year state budget and a lot of other issues that came up. What's your assessment of how things went during this past session?
Well, this is my third budget, if you will, and I do sit on Ways and Means, so I get to see it firsthand. Many things are the same. One of the things that we keep working on is if we can build the economy, we can build the revenues and more to work with. There's not a shortage of needs. I always like to joke that we see billions of dollars of requests that are reasonable and worthy requests, but there's only so much money.
This time around, of course, you had some very important issues and talking about expenditures, trying to come up with the revenue to deal with crumbling infrastructure, mainly roads and bridges and the like across the state. We have our share here in Northwest Indiana for sure, don't we?
Indeed. It's a major issue, and I know Representative Soliday has been working on this for many years and trying to establish just exactly what our cost is and where we stand. And after many studies and evaluations, we came to the conclusion we were more than $1 billion short in what it took to not only maintain what we needed, but to construct maintain what we have and construct what we need. So those are pretty big numbers. And no matter how much we try to cut the budget, we're not going to cut our way to that solution.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways I know then dealing with the infrastructure issue was to restructure how the revenues can be raised to be able to pay for all that work. We're talking about increases in the gasoline tax and some other things. And did things shape up the way that you and maybe other Republicans at the State House thought might work?
I think it worked out really well. You know, in the legislative process, we call it sausage making. And you never quite know how it's going to come out the other end. But hopefully, and I believe that was the case this time, that we end up with a pretty good result. We did add 10 cents a gallon to the gasoline tax, which hadn't been done since 2002. So this was really about getting back to the purchasing power we had at that time. You can imagine we have less consumption now than we did because more efficient automobiles, and then a loss of purchasing power over time. So we were really falling drastically behind, and it was necessary to do something. What's most important is that we moved those dollars into a separate fund. It's out of the general fund, so it's not really available to be used for other things. And we had, and I think most people understand this, there was some amount of that gasoline tax used for other things. Mm-hmm. Over the next few years, we're going to have all of that moved over into road maintenance so that it is outside the general fund, so that all those revenues are committed to go to that purpose.
I know one of the other topics that had come up, and certainly of very much of interest here in Northwest Indiana, deals with the South Shore Railroad. South Shore Line, trying to make improvements that have been asked for by the operators and owners of the line to make travel easier between the points here in Northwest Indiana and Chicago, and even points to the east as well, too, mainly broken down between the two projects that NICTI has set up, the double tracking, which is basically in the Gary area that deals between Gary and Michigan City, and also the improvements that have to be made on the train lines through Michigan City itself. And then, of course, we have the Westlake project, which is being proposed. Tell us what you had proposed and your colleagues at the State House to be able to make sure that the projects are staying on literally on track. No pun intended, but making sure that the projects get done and hopefully in some semblance of order, that one thing gets done, everything else follows through.
Indeed, that's a very interesting story. I'll try to cut through it quickly. 2 years ago, we had the Westlake project, and at that point in time, the state's commitment was $6 million a year for the next 30 years. It seemed unlikely to us that we would get an additional amount of money for the double tracking. Fortunately, the new governor saw the value of connecting the main line stops, Michigan City, South Bend, Miller Beach, and the like, to the Chicago market. And so it helped having him behind this. What we did was we came up with a mechanism that would assure the people of Indiana a real good return on their investment if they were to commit some more dollars for that purpose. And so the bill that we came up with, 1144, was one that did that, to make sure that we saw development along the line in all communities.
That was one of the important things. I know that NICTI and even the Regional Development Authority had been bringing up to the session's start and through the session as well, about the importance of seeing to it that what they called, and make sure I get the termination right, transit development districts.
That's correct.
Getting them set up within the areas that are being served by the South Shore line, and in turn to help make sure that the communities around the line itself grow and prosper as well. So they see some benefit out of seeing more people on the trains, more trains running between South Bend and Chicago.
Well, we're looking to bring in private investment into these projects. And the best way to do that is to simplify the financing process. And by putting the RDA in charge of that part of it we're hoping will have a big impact. The real story here is the fact that if we had four counties involved on this, St. Joe, LaPorte, Porter, and Lake, getting four counties to agree on the sun coming up in the morning is somewhat of a challenge. And so we had to come up with a mechanism that they could all agree to on funding their share of this double tracking, and that's also included in 1144.
Now, since the measure has now become law by being signed by the governor, from what you understand from Governor Holcomb, how is the process going to come along now to make sure that the funds come into the RDA so that this project gets moving along like it should?
Well, we set up in the bill the mechanisms with multiple options for these counties on how they would participate, as well as intercept provisions that we needed to put in place if we were ever going to sell bonds. Just like any other banker, a bondholder wants to make sure that the revenue stream is there. And so all of that has been established. We didn't come back here leaving it up to the locals to try to work some things out with interlocal agreements. It's done.
What are some of the other measures that you sponsored or at least co-sponsored in this past legislative session that are now either becoming law or certainly are moving ahead now? Maybe they didn't quite make it this time around, but will likely come up and be considered in future sessions that are going to benefit Lake County in particular.
Well, one that I'm particularly proud of is we finally obtained the funding necessary for Purdue Northwest Calumet campus to replace a building that was well behind in deferred maintenance and was giving them a lot of trouble. They're going to be able to build a biosciences facility, which is going to change that campus and how it looks and how people work within it.
I know they've been working very hard to build up the academic side and encourage the programs to thrive. And I guess now you have to catch up with the physical structure, don't you?
Indeed. That campus has gone from what I like to call a community college to, it's a four-year institution. They're pulling people in from all over the state and Illinois. Mm-hmm. And this is just a part of that. And of course, now we're going to have a commuter rail line that gets those students closer.
One of the other measures I know that you had sponsored and had gotten through the General Assembly this time around is dealing mainly with political parties, in this case trying to readjust the size of precincts in Lake County in particular. Tell us about the problem that you saw that in turn led you to make a bill that basically got through the legislature to try to deal with how to reconfigure the precincts in the county.
Right, and there's quite a bit of misunderstanding with that. Of course, there's a tremendous cost savings by consolidating some of these small precincts. We've all gone to the polls and seen lots of poll workers sitting there without much to do, and that's because some of these precincts have so few voters. And then, of course, with the addition of early voting, we're getting 27-28% now voting early, so that even drops those numbers further. The real issue, though, has got to do with one person, one vote. We've had a tremendous shift in population from the north to the south, and those precinct committeemen are in place basically to replace an open position. Somebody retires or leaves a position for some reason. It's the precinct organization structure that comes up with that replacement. On a countywide position, I think most people would agree they want to have their relative influence. They don't want it to be stacked in one area unreasonably because the population no longer fits the votes that they get.
Now, when do you expect to see some kind of impact, if it comes from that, in the next election coming up?
Well, I think the timing in the bill was set up so that we're not going to be forcing any existing precinct committeemen out of their position. It'll be kind of a normal restructure and election process will take place. And I think that's next year that all of that will take place in the primary.
One other thing I wanted to ask when we had a chance to talk with you here in the studio, Representative Slager, is your take on what you think are some of the issues that maybe that because there was such a strong focus on making sure some important issues were dealt with in the 2017 session, that could possibly come up in 2018.
Well, we're still trying to catch our breath on that, but we always have issues in the hopper. The things that you've talked about and we've talked about, whether it's the building at Purdue or the double tracking or the road funding, all of these issues have taken years to come along and be done and come out of the oven. It seems like a lot of them came together in this session. And so we have more of those things that are ongoing, some of which, one in particular that's close to me, has to do with pediatric care for medically complex issues here in Northwest Indiana. We have children that have to travel, if they're Medicaid patients, having to travel to Riley in Indianapolis, which is a fine hospital, because the Chicago hospitals don't get the same level of reimbursement for Medicaid the way Medicaid is structured. And so they have to travel to Riley, which it's 150 miles. But if you've got a sick child that's had chemotherapy in the car and a couple other children in the car, it's a very difficult circumstance for parents. And if they can't work, that's making it even worse.
And so I can understand, because you've got the opportunities so close by, but you can kind of understand why physicians are a little hesitant to be involved in helping patients from Indiana if they're over in Illinois and they don't get the reimbursement for the expenses they face.
Indeed, and I've had meetings with Lurie Children's and as well as Comer and trying to resolve some of the issues that are taking place with Indiana Medicaid reimbursement, and I've even had meetings with some of the institutions here in Northwest Indiana trying to encourage them to handle some of these outpatient issues for these medically complex children would be a big benefit to our region.
Do you see any encouraging signs from the discussions you've had?
I do. There's a great interest. As long as we can work through some of these reimbursement issues, I think we can see some change there. Whether or not that's going to take legislation, I don't know yet. We're still working through it.
We're talking with State Representative Hal Slager, who is a Republican from Schererville. If you're not familiar with his district, House District 15, it includes all of the communities of Schererville, as well as Dyer and St. John Township and portions of the community of St. John and Griffith here in Lake County. Thank you for stopping by. We appreciate your comments and the best of luck to you. And here as you start planning for this next legislative session. And of course, we were even commenting before about it's now getting back to regular life now, getting back to regular business, I suppose, too, after spending time dealing with the people's business in Indianapolis.
Indeed. We've got real jobs as well.
That's right. It's the thing about being a citizen legislator when you're here in Indiana. Well, thank you very much for being with us today, sir.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Summer driving season not far away, and Chicagoland AAA, along with the other AAA organizations around the country, will be out helping motorists that find themselves in trouble. And to find out here in Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state, as well as Illinois, how that organization is going to shape up, is Beth Mosier with AAA here in Chicagoland. Beth, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
I guess we will have people that when they get out to do their vacation travels will find themselves in trouble. And what do the statistics show, at least in the past, of people that have been out there and maybe didn't have their cars or their trucks checked out to be sure they could travel safely?
We are expecting to rescue 7 million American drivers this summer, over 300,000 people just in Indiana alone. The majority of drivers are going to have battery trouble, lockouts, tire-related issues, the majority of drivers that we will help in any way. So we're really asking people to take this time, particularly with Memorial Day weekend coming up, to get their car checked out before they head out on that summer road trip.
Well, it seems like the battery problems are on the top of the list of where people have the most problems, isn't it?
Absolutely. Dead batteries, particularly in that summer heat, is the number one reason that we come to the rescue for people across the country.
Now, I guess we can just ask for some advice here. What should we be doing with our vehicles before we get ready for that vacation travel?
Well, certainly go in and schedule a checkup. So many people have never had their battery tested, and if your battery is over 3 years old, particularly if you're driving an older car, you really need to go have your battery tested. Make sure your fluid levels check out, get your oil change, make sure your tires are inflated to where they need to be. So just make sure that your car has a proper tune-up before you head out on the road. And then also pack an emergency kit with you in the car. We normally think of emergency kits in winter weather, but certainly important to have with you in the summer as well. Make sure you have a mobile phone charger, flashlight, extra batteries, first aid kit of some sort, and basic toolkit, so that if you are stranded, you at least have something in your car that can help you.
Now, I guess we mentioned earlier that the lockouts are a big problem that AAA crews tend to have to help out on when called in by members at the highway and other places. What are some of the wise things to do about lockouts?
Really, lockouts are one of the top reasons that we get called. Take a spare set of keys with you, particularly if you're heading out on a road trip. You'd hate to be across the country and have no spare keys with you. That's the big thing. Make sure that if you have a key fob, make sure that key fob battery is replaced as well. One of those better be safe than sorry types of situations, and we've had to come to the rescue of many people, fob or no fob.
We're talking with Beth Mosher with Chicagoland AAA about being aware of the problems you can run into on summer travel and some common sense things, and also some common sense notions that you'd probably have anyway about travel in particular when you're behind the wheel. It's very easy to get distracted, and we're not talking about looking at the sights and the scenery either, are we?
The sights of the scenery, billboards can certainly be a distraction out there, but most commonly we find that distractions come in the form of cell phones, people eating in the car, but also a distraction that we don't think of very often as a distraction is other people that are in the car with you. We see this a lot with teenagers especially. They're distracted by the passenger sitting next to them. So be sure, no matter who's driving, that you're driving distraction-free. Let the passenger handle any cell phone, any GPS navigation, that sort of thing. The driver really needs to focus on the task at hand, which is driving. Mm-hmm.
Now, we've talked about the problems you can run into and you have problems with your own vehicle. Common sense advice I know AAA always offers to people, if you do have problems and out there on the highways, get out of the way, I guess, is probably a quick way to put it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we can't stress this enough. Comply with the move over law. It's the law in all 50 states, so no matter where you're traveling, you need to slow down, move over. If you see a car ahead with its flashers on or emergency crews out there, and that includes police, fire, tow trucks, all of those vehicles. And those people who are traveling from Indiana to Illinois may not be aware of this, but now the Illinois law has changed such that if any car has its flashers on, the move over law applies to them as well. So take it easy out there on the roadway. Slow down, move over.
You mentioned earlier here about a wise move that if you're traveling with family members or friends, that somebody to be your lookout to take care of your navigation so you can spend your time paying attention to what's happening ahead in the road. And especially if you get into a situation like that where there is a vehicle ahead that's over, even off to the side of the road, you still have to get out of the way and you'll have to be able to change lanes. It means you have to pay attention to what's going on around you too, won't it?
Absolutely. And AAA has experience. We know that the state police have experience. Just absolute tragic deaths on the roadway because service technicians or police officers have been killed because people not pulling over, not slowing down. Just absolutely be aware of what's going on the roadway there. Slow down and move over. Give the folks who are out there helping on the roadways the space that they need to do their job safely.
That is Beth Mosier with the Chicagoland AAA, and we'll check back in with Beth a little closer to the Memorial Day holiday weekend for AAA's prediction on holiday traffic. As communities such as East Chicago grapple with lead contamination, they face a challenge for after cleanup, what to do about redeveloping and revitalizing once toxic neighborhoods. Down south, in Evansville, community leaders there have been using decades of remediation to their advantage. And we find out more in this from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek.
In what was once the most contaminated part of the Jacobsville Neighborhood Superfund site in Evansville, a vacant lot sits waiting. Chris Metz, the assistant director of the local housing organization known as ECHO, gestures proudly at the sod covering the lead-free ground.
So as we're standing here right now, we're standing where Garfield Commons will be.
The 44-apartment complex will provide more housing specifically for employees of nearby companies. ECHO also built new housing around the corner for formerly homeless disabled veterans. The nonprofit and the city hope to return this area to a vitality it hasn't known in decades.
We do have some kind of dilapidated housing in the area. We have older housing stock that is visible from right here, but this is going to be a brand new, gleaming, shining complex. So this is going to impact the people that live here, but this also should have a substantial economic impact on the community as well.
Metz's boss, ECHO Executive Director Stephanie Tenbarge, says all this is thanks to the Environmental Protection Agency. The companies that caused the contamination can't pay to clean it up. They went out of business decades ago. So the EPA is footing the entire estimated $156 million bill. If any developer had faced even a fraction of that, Tenbarge says,
this would just been a contaminated neighborhood forever.
The EPA made 4.5 square miles around Jacobsville a Superfund site in 2004 after state officials discovered that lead dust from old foundries spread into the yards of thousands of homes. 83 were so hazardous they required emergency cleanup in 2007. Since then, the EPA has cleaned more than 2,000 additional Jacobsville yards. It's not addressing every site. The contamination isn't severe enough to make the cut at non-residential properties. The EPA's Midwest Superfund chief, Donald Bruce, says locals played an unusually big role in shaping those plans and in making sure Jacobsville could become more than a landfill or industrial space.
Here, we've got a residential cleanup that's interspersed throughout the community. So I think in that respect, the reuse that we're seeing is somewhat unique.
Joe Easley is a retired pastor at a neighborhood church who helps lead the Jacobsville Area Community Corporation. They were the EPA's main partner in community outreach, which Easley says wasn't always easy.
People in the area were hesitant to have it identified as a Superfund site because they thought, oh my God, that's gonna say we're a contaminated area. Well, we were a contaminated area, and the only way to get funds to fix it was to designate it a Superfund site.
Easley says the slow cleanup stalled some pre-existing plans, but also created more time to think bigger and longer term. He says Jacobsville also had to build collaborations with the city and big local businesses.
You know, I'd like to think that government would listen to the concerns of ordinary citizens and citizens in poor neighborhoods, but the fact is that doesn't carry as much weight as big voices. And organization, an organized community, gets more done.
This is 16 blocks. It's exactly 1 mile. And it's the most innovative road project Evansville's ever undertaken.
City Development Director Kelly Kors surveys construction on North Main Street, an artery through Jacobsville where a new bike lane and other upgrades are taking shape. This neighborhood is still in transition, with high crime and poverty rates, and only a small fraction of the people who work here live here, too.
This neighborhood needed to lift itself up out of that disinvestment.
Now, with cleanup more than halfway done, the plans to make that happen are starting to bear fruit. Kors says it wasn't always easy for the city to balance remediation with redevelopment, but he remembers one city councilor asking,
"Where's the neighborhood going to be in 10 years if we don't do this? If we don't start the land bank, if we don't clear the blight out, if we don't resurrect this street and make it something new and urban and interesting, what happens then?"
One thing's for sure, Jacobsville will still be dealing with lead contamination. The EPA has at least 2,000 more homes to clean up. They estimate they'll need 5 to 10 years to do it. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Evansville.
Got good news from the operator of the Hoosier State passenger rail service between Indianapolis and Chicago, with stops at Dyer and Rensselaer. Amtrak is reporting that ridership and revenue went up in the months of March and April compared to the same months last year. They've also noted, too, a faster schedule between the two cities. To talk more about it, we have the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, Steve Coxhead, with us. Thank you, Steve, for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Chris. Happy to be here.
Yeah, the information may be early, I guess, because it's only been a few months since Amtrak took back the service that Iowa Pacific had been running on the Hoosier State line. But it seems like at least they're off on a good start, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Amtrak is offering a somewhat higher quality of service than they offered before Iowa Pacific. And, of course, the good news is the biennial budget just passed includes funds for the Hoosier State as a line item in the Department of Transportation budget. And I believe that's a first for Indiana.
Does it seem that maybe that the lawmakers in Indianapolis, seeing the changeover, that Iowa Pacific had made a try at it, although unfortunately not a very successful try business-wise, but that they have left the Hoosier State line in a little better shape than what they inherited it?
Yes, I think a couple of things have happened. One, the visibility of the existence of the service was raised in the eyes of the public. Many more people are aware that you can take a train from Indy to Chicago and points in between. And also, I think the Iowa Pacific experiment demonstrated that there is definitely a market in this corridor for a premium service, you know, something more than bare bones, and that people do see the train as a viable way to get from the center of the state up to Chicago and northwest Indiana. So we've made progress. Several people in the General Assembly are enthusiastic, and I think our new Governor Holcomb actually is enthusiastic about the project also.
What do you think that Iowa Pacific had brought to the table, even though that they weren't able to keep it going for any longer than they could? What do you think that they brought to the riders as well as the supporters of the Hoosier State that Amtrak has been able to hang on to and to continue that seem to be making it very popular right now?
Right. I think what Iowa Pacific brought to the table was the right vision, okay? You know, the idea of a modern service, the idea of eventually more than just one train a day in each direction, the idea of something that would be attractive that people would want to use, would see as a viable alternative to driving or flying in this market. That had not been there previously. I don't think on the part either of Amtrak or on the part of our state's Department of Transportation. And what Ed Ellis brought to the table was that vision. And the experiment, I think, showed that that vision was, in fact, the way to go. And NDOT and Amtrak, I think, have bought into that to one extent or another.
Do you get the impression that Amtrak, maybe they're not going to be upping the ante, so to speak? They're not going to be adding many new services other than what they've inherited here. But it is an improvement from what it was before. But they at least to be pleased that they've seen something that's promising to them, that maybe that Amtrak in the future, if they get the financial support like they're hoping to get from the state, to be able to make better improvements and even more amenities for those people that travel to Hoosier State.
Yeah, you know, part of the problem is, like, nationwide, Amtrak only gets so good. Outside of the Northeast Corridor, you know, Amtrak really isn't in a position to supply the kind of amenities that, let's say, an Iowa Pacific would. Now, That may change depending upon what happens to Amtrak's financing and funding in the Congress. And, of course, that's still an open question, as we all know. I think it's very interesting because it does definitely leave open the question of a private sector partner. It did not work with Iowa Pacific. There are other potential private sector partners. If Amtrak is able to supply something attractive, something useful, that would be excellent. On the other hand, Amtrak is not the only player in the game. And I think the way the Iowa Pacific project ended up is that we showed that, this is a viable way to go. We have to get the contract right. We have to get the service level right. But this is a viable way to go. It's not just, someone's wild fantasy.
The latest report that came out from Amtrak here talking about the March and April ridership as well as the revenue for the Hoosier State service noted that for example, it's arriving about 11 minutes earlier into Indianapolis at Union Station, and it's arriving about 5 minutes earlier in Union Station in Chicago. What's your understanding as to why that we picked up some improvement in the travel times now?
Well, the original Amtrak schedule, it basically had a lot of cushion built into it, because of problems with dispatching between Dyer and Chicago, and, problems at the CSX physical plant. A lot of those problems can be solved if attention is paid to the problem, okay? And I think Amtrak may actually be paying more attention to the dispatching issue, and other things, as a result partly of the fact that both people and politicians in Indiana are taking more notice of the service now. So in a respect, it's a people problem. I know I've had conversations with people involved, for instance, in the Iowa Pacific operation, and a lot depends on how you handle the dispatching, between Dyer and Union Station. So I actually think Amtrak is making a greater effort in that respect. And they're able to squeeze a little bit of that cushion that had built into the schedule for a long time. I know historically, and this is something some of us want to shoot for, Indianapolis to Chicago was a 3-3.5 hour run.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the goal. And I think it's realistic to aim for that.
Do you think that maybe in that case, and we've talked about this before in our past conversations, about the fact that the best way to get the best service would be to have a separate dedicated line, or maybe it would be shared by other passenger rails if it's likely to happen, to have a dedicated line between Chicago and Indianapolis to be able to get quicker times that you don't have to worry about the freight trains getting in the way?
Well, of course, that would be ideal. But I honestly think we're a long way from doing that. I think you've got a lot of mileage that can be made out of improving the existing route and, working more effectively with CSX and so forth. CSX being the Class 1 railroad that basically owns most of the trackage between Indy and Chicago. And I think we've talked before, people have talked of true high-speed rail up in the 220-mile-an-hour range. Mm-hmm. And there, yeah, you need dedicated roadbeds. But we're not there yet. I think most of us feel we're still at the point where we can get a lot of mileage out of working with CSX and the existing physical plant.
I suppose when you think about even the Northeast corridor of the country where we see even more heavy rail traffic, we don't have that speed or anything close to it now because it's so congested there. So I guess if they work out the problems on the East Coast, eventually we'll get some benefit out of that here in the Midwest, won't we?
Yeah, and of course, part of the problem in the Northeast Corridor is you've got a huge amount of deferred maintenance. They're still using bridges and tunnels that are literally a century old. And I know there's been a great deal of discussion about the potential problem with, like, the Hudson River tunnels. There is a problem in the Northeast Corridor, and it's similar to what we have in the Hoosier State Corridor, the capital cost of maintenance and new construction. So I would expect we're going to see some problems in the Northeast Corridor by and by with maintenance issues that finally just can't be put off.
Do you think that that you and your colleagues that are members of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance feel very pleased about what has happened so far with the Hoosier State and I guess hoping to see some improvements as well, though, on Amtrak's other service that runs through Indiana, mainly the Cardinal? As I know there are a lot of people concentrate on talking about the Hoosier State, but the Cardinal needs to be improved as well, too.
Oh, Cardinal is a definite part of the issue. There is movement to get a seven-day Cardinal with improved service. In fact, the West Virginia legislature has just passed legislation calling for the creation of what would amount to an interstate compact, which would involve formal cooperation of all of the states served by the Cardinal to maintain and improve that service. Now, that's just in the very, very formative stages. But that's something that's definitely in the wind. And, it's an important part. If we had a seven-day Cardinal, for instance, we could put the Hoosier State on a different schedule, and then with very little effort, instead of one train a day in each direction, you get two trains a day in each direction.
I guess that would make it even better for people that would like to take the train between Indy and Chicago and vice versa. They have a better, like you say, you have the improved service, and more people would probably travel, and that would improve not only the ridership, but it would improve the cost as well, or the revenue, rather, that those people would have to, what people would pay for basically their train ticket, and the cost that would be for Amtrak to keep up the service for both lines, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. The key is getting to the point where you could leave Northwest Indiana or Chicago in the morning, go to Indianapolis and get back in the evening. That would be probably the biggest thing we could do to engineer a quantum change in ridership. And if you're talking about generating enough fare box revenue to cover costs, that's one of the things you have to do eventually.
Steve. It's nice to hear some good news here. Like I said, it's very positive that we haven't heard for a long time, it seems, on either of the passenger rail lines.
Yeah. We're not, you know, there yet, but there's definitely been some improvements. When we first started looking at this 3 years ago, I have to say that NDOT was not really enthusiastic about passenger rail, and now we've gotten to the point where the people involved at NDOT really are quite enthusiastic. And, we have to work things out politically, and it has to be paid for. But there's been kind of a sea change in the state's attitude, and I think that is real progress.
Steve Coxhead is the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. Steve, thanks very much for being with us. Give us your take on the good news that's come from Amtrak here on at least only a couple months of ridership and revenue for the Hoosier State Passenger Rail Line. But it's certainly very encouraging to go into the rest of the good weather months and finding out how traffic on the trains are going to be. Thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you for inviting me.
The Lake County Sheriff's Department is partnering with the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health and the State Department of Health to come up with a special screening program inside the Lake County Jail. Sheriff John Buncich was with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about it. He says a percentage of the Crown Point Jail's inmates contracted the viruses of not only HIV but hepatitis C through illegal intravenous drug use.
Several months ago, individuals from the Indiana State Department of Health come in, and they were talking to us about infectious diseases, especially in institutions, jails and such in Indiana. And they were sent up here as a result of the epidemic proportions in some of the counties in southern Indiana that they're experiencing with drug usage and resulting in HIV and Hep C infectious diseases, the rise in that those two diseases. We then, after they left, I found that very, very interesting, and we contacted the Indiana University, the Fairbanks School of Public Health, who they're on the forefront of this type of treatment in the state of Indiana. In the nation, as a matter of fact. And we put together a program that they're going to do some random testing within our facility. It's going to begin this week, and we'll be able to take a snapshot of several hundred of the inmates that come in who will voluntarily submit to the blood tests. It's going to be kept anonymous. The names will not be published. Of course, our medical records team will have that information, but it will not be released otherwise. But what we want to do, Chris, is we want to get a handle on exactly how bad these diseases are here in Lake County, and especially within our facility, these individuals that are coming in. Any given day, we have anywhere from 700 to 750 population. We're finding now that our rate of those individuals is really going up drastically with that are HIV infected and Hep C infected. And what that does is the medical, the prescription costs on that is just skyrocketing. It's really some of the, especially the HIV, the treatment for that. And then, you know, these individuals, we'll treat them here, like, you know, for these type of diseases. But then they go out into the community, you know, and then, again, you've got these communicable diseases that they're carrying out in the community. So once we get the results of this, we want a snapshot of just how serious it is within our facility, and then also we'll be able to, in the community as a whole in Lake County. And what we intend to do is work with the local health services throughout Lake County to see what we can do to try to lessen this problem and, of course, reduce the added cost to the county. You know, I've been doing a lot of work with, and I applaud her, Coroner Marilee Fry. We've had a terrible, terrible increase in heroin addiction, heroin overdoses, and subsequent deaths. I mean, it's increasing at an alarming rate. You don't read too much about it in the paper when a young individual, and I'm talking anywhere from 15, 16, up into the mid-20s and early 30s that are dying from overdoses. And again, the usage of needles, you know, repeated usage of needles, which leads to HIV, and then also the Hep C. So this is going to give us somewhat of an idea where we're at here.
In years past, it has been the case where, especially with HIV, that it was always told that that the worst of the cases happened because of unprotected sex. But are we seeing nowadays, because of the opioid abuse explosion, that there are more drug abusers or people who have taken drugs that are the ones that are coming down with not only HIV but with Hep C?
Exactly. That's what it is. Repeated needle usage, you know, and it's just in addition to the sexually transmitted aspect of it.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that you've noticed over time, of course, with the big population that you have at the Lake County Jail on a regular basis, that we're coming in with cases like this, inmates coming in, and no doubt inmates that are there for long periods of time who have contracted HIV or Hep C, to be sure. And you mentioned about the expense, too, that you have to deal with. Give us an idea, if you will, how expensive it is that for the county jail and the sheriff's department, because you're in charge of it.
In talking to my medical team, I was surprised to hear that just HIV treatment, the amount of medication, could amount to up to $10,000 a month.
Oh.
Yeah, when you start looking at that, you know, when you have more of one in a few of these individuals, that's going to really put a burden on us, you know, with our costs for medication.
Sheriff Bunch, you mentioned about the fact that the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health is going to be helping in tallying up some of the information that you're going to be able to get together from the testing and the like. Tell us how they fit into the equation as far as what you want to do there at the Lake County Jail.
Well, we sought them out, and like I said, they're known throughout the nation. It's one of the finest public health schools.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they're speaking with these individuals, their credentials speak for themselves and the testing that they've done, you know, for other institutions. And but I want to point this out that here in Lake County, we're in the forefront of doing this type of research, these types of surveys and everything else. And, you know, we've been under a Department of Justice watch for years now that we're almost out of completely, and working in conjunction with the county council, the commissioners, and I think this is going to add one further step closer where we're going to be able to take some proactive measures. The times are changing. The increase in these infectious diseases and the epidemic with the opioid addiction and that, to say, hey, enough is enough. We have to do something, see what we can do for prevention and intervention on a proactive basis.
That's Lake County Sheriff John Bunsich on a recent Regionally Speaking. On this Monday, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tricia Hernandez, Director of Development at South Shore Arts. Welcome back, Trish.
Thanks, John.
And we're going to talk a little bit about our big fundraiser coming up, the annual Beaux-Arts Ball.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yes. So tell us about it.
Tell us a few words here. Okay. So it's Friday, June 2nd.
Uh-huh.
And our theme this year is very fun with a little help from our friends. So we have a Beatles twist, but even a more sincere message in that the arts always need help from their friends to support us. And so we thought we would have some fun with that. And I do want to say, too, right from the start that it is June 2nd. It's on a Friday night. It's black tie. But if you didn't get an invitation in the mail, just give us a call. Yeah. Just give us a call, because we can't possibly know everybody that might want to come. And we would love anybody to come that wants to come. So
we have a Beatles band this year.
We have a Beatles band, the Chris and Lou Band. And so they do great Beatles cover songs. Mm-hmm. And rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have some excellent dancing. And then we're also going mobile this year. So
terrifying.
It's very terrifying.
We're so high tech. Nothing like dragging and kicking into the 21st century.
Right. So people who are coming to the ball or even not coming to the ball actually can register at artsball.gesture.com. And as of May 26th, you can start bidding on some of our items.
So anybody in the whole wide world can bid.
Whole wide world.
The www. The whole wide world.
The www.artsball.gesture.com. So that's all new for us. But it'll be fun, like the ball always is. And the reason we do it is for our outreach programs in the community for kids. And so we work within the schools and other organizations, other not-for-profits. And that's how we get art education out into the community.
Which we take great pride in being able to serve all of these kids in all of the Northwest Indiana and many South Suburban Illinois communities as well. And they have a big impact on people's lives. And we've been doing it for over 20 years now, this kind of educational outreach, what we call the Every Kid Program. And so now the kids who were our original scholarship students and the original participants in these programs are adults, and many of them are working artists. Mm-hmm. And there was a study that just came out about employment in the arts in Indiana, and there's actually more self-employment in the arts than in any other arts-related sector of employment in Northwest Indiana. So a lot of people are doing it themselves, living independent lives and making livings as artists in their chosen
absolutely. And many have come back to us and donated or taught classes or
they help out.
Yeah, that circle of life is really, really nice.
Our education director, Jillian, was a participant in the high school show.
Years ago.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So that's wonderful. And that show, which happens to be up right now at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster, started out 43 years ago in the mid-70s.
So
it's great.
And it's something like 800 entries and 33 schools. And yeah. So our kids' programs are strong, but they're only strong because people come to the ball and people support these programs through their donations.
Right.
Do I have a minute to even say, if you can't come to the ball, there are other ways you can participate. You can send us a donation, and any monetary donation is welcome. Or you can help us with our auction and donate something for the silent auction. It all goes to the bottom line and to help raise money for the Every Kid program. So you don't just have to come. You can bid online. You can donate an auction item or make a monetary donation.
But if you do come, it is a lot of fun. And
it
we
is.
Have a fun evening. And it's $175 per person.
Yes.
It's an open bar. It's great food. And it's just it's a really active evening. It's a jam-packed evening with a lot going on, and we do have a lot of fun. We have a lot of young people who come to the Beaux-Arts Ball these days, and we have a young committee that attracts a really cool group of people. So
and we dance till midnight.
Oh Lord, well, some of us. I sit
we have to drag John out at the very end.
Yeah, just it's over, people.
It's over. Go home.
All right. Well, thanks, Trish, for being here to tell us about it. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
That's John Kane talking with Trish Hernandez, the Director of Marketing and Development for South Shore Arts, about the upcoming 23rd Annual Beaux Arts Ball that's going to happen on Friday, June 3rd. And join us next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we will explore further in looking at the opioid addiction about the gray death, which is one of the latest challenges in the addiction crisis. We hope you'll join us for that conversation.